Citizen Reporter number 360, 15th of December 2010, and we start with a trailer.
I like my home. I have the sea. I have my crops. I could live.
This is all these people know. Their whole culture, their life, everything is here.
God has spoke to me through the dream. I saw the sea coming into the island and destroying all the garden food.
This one too is getting yellow, see? A sign of dying.
Question that ora. Kuwait naman mag-iibalik yan ang dato.
The government does not do anything.
I came here to tell you people that we have to leave what we have and move out from this island.
I don't think the culture can work if we take it out to other lands.
Small island surrounding by this ocean. Kimera Tamara in Seloma, Mahataira, Amagiraisa.
I'm a little worried that this afternoon we will see waves and maybe a little worse even.
Oh no, this one great big one coming.
Maybe he'll find nobody on this island. We'll all be gone.
If you lose something small in the world, you lose a lot.
All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to CitizenReporter.org, the podcast that focuses on underreported news and global concerns. And this evening, I have the great pleasure of having a guest all the way from California, originally from New Zealand. Her name is Briar Marsh. She's on the line now. Hello, Briar.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, and I'm very pleased to have you here. You are the director of the documentary, which I got to see at the International Documentary Film Festival here in Amsterdam just over, I guess that was 2 weeks ago now. There Once Was an Island. I know you've been getting a lot of questions about the film, and that's probably a good thing. I definitely wanted to bring both you and the film to my podcast and to my listeners, because I really was so interested in it, and it was one of the more powerful ones of the film festival. So let's start from the beginning. I mean, what were you doing when this whole concept came to you?
Well, it was actually a long time ago now when I think back. It started in 2006, and I was looking for a film about the issue of climate change. I was interested in this issue of climate change, but I'd seen many films that were told from more of a scientific perspective, you know, with talking heads, kinds of very journalistic style films, and I wanted to do something that was more character-driven, you know, sort of like the human face or the human perspective. At the time, I was living in New Zealand, and there was a lot of talk in New Zealand about this idea that many Pacific Islanders may have to relocate to New Zealand, since New Zealand and Australia are probably the most developed countries in the Pacific, and a lot of maybe smaller islands, that would be an option for them to move to countries like ours. Yeah. So I had read articles about this in the paper, and one that I had come across was about a very, very remote atoll in Papua New Guinea called Taku, which is 250 kilometers northeast of Bougainville. And this very small community, only 500 people living there on a small atoll that's only 1 meter above sea level, were talking about the changes that they'd seen in their island, and to the extent that the government in Bougainville, the ABG, Autonomous Bougainville government, had started to make a relocation plan for them. And so I was like, oh my gosh, this is actually, people are actually talking about moving already, and maybe there's a story here. And in New Zealand, there was an ethnomusicologist called Richard Moyle who'd been going to this island over 14 years, and not many people had been there at all because it's so remote. There's only maybe on average 4 boat trips that are serviced to the island in a year. So it's quite difficult to get there. And so I talked to Richard Moyle, the ethnomusicologist, about his travels and how he got in touch with the community, because, again, that's a difficult thing to do since there's no, you know, internet or telephones and things. And he was the way through, in a way, and he introduced me to the Ariki, the chief, and I heard from him that they were actually wanting a filmmaker to come and look at the situation. So I managed to get to the island in to the end of 2006, and that's where I guess the whole project began.
And you go to the island thinking, let me film not only aspects, you know, about what's changing in terms of the rising sea level, but you also wanted to, I mean, because the result is not only aspects about the science, about the changes in the weather, but also aspects of culture. Religion. Yeah. I mean, you did like a full picture of what is a big community.
Yeah, well, this is because, I mean, one, I didn't just want to look at the science. I wanted to look at the way environmental change is impacting people on an emotional and a cultural level, not only, you know, not only on the environmental, physical level. And I thought that making a film about an island in a way, making a film about a community on an island is like a microcosm of a macrocosm. It's sort of like an allegory for the entire planet and for the way we all respond to change and how we deal with change. You know, I mean, you have some people who look at religion for an answer, and some people who look at science for an answer, and other people who choose not to make a decision and try and ignore what's happening. So I think that all of those things I saw happening on the island, and I mean, not only that, change is happening on the island, just globalization in general. I mean, these people have been living a very traditional life for many, many years and have really been quite separated from the modern world, if you want to put it like that. I mean, they've resisted Christianity and missionaries, and they have been, you know, practicing their traditional Polynesian religion, one of the last groups in the world to still practice their traditional religion. So there's a lot of change already happening that just is quite, you know, yeah, just a situation of our times.
Yeah, any time in the film that there was a big meeting of the community, and whenever I heard the word or the term or the whatever you want to call it, God, used, I always thought, uh-oh, you know, they're going to say, God says we stay here, so we stay. And I thought that'll be the end of it. But what was interesting about watching this film is that even though several people said, look, you know, God is watching us, and that clearly they believed in a God, that didn't mean that they thought that their God wanted them to stay. I mean, there was a whole group of people who, despite being Christian, well, at least the woman who was sort of leading them in this whole discussion, said, you know, I'm a Christian, I believe in God, but we need to leave this place.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's very interesting. So there was like, there's a pastor who says, God is going to protect us.
Right,
and
that was my fear, that everybody would just stick with that. Yeah.
And then there's this other woman who says, as you say, we should move. And I mean, it's really interesting because I feel like this is just an example of even religion in general. You know, there are many different ways we interpret things. And I mean, she had this whole narrative about Sodom and Gomorrah, and like how unless the islanders did things in a way that was more Christian and like got rid of some of the things that she thought were not Christian, like practicing the traditional religion, God wouldn't protect the island. So, I mean, this is one sort of narrative that, I mean, it might seem amazing to some people, but then I've heard that kind of story many times in many different places in the world. But I think also the one thing about Anda is that she's lived outside of the island. And so she's an expatriate. She's come back. And as a woman, I think she's really seen how many more opportunities that she has outside the island, getting an education, being able to work. And so to her, she sees those things as positive changes. And of course, she's worrying about the future, but she's also thinking, well, this will be beneficial for my community if we start to move off the island and embrace some of these aspects of modernity.
The other thing that interested me a lot in the film was the whole aspect of what the government wanted to do or what option they gave to the islanders. And there was the moment where you're back on the mainland, if that's the right term for it, and you talk a little bit about what the government was offering everyone, which was essentially a bit of land, not like the one they currently live on, but some inland plot.
So the Bougainville government is still in the process of trying to find a piece of land. And the plantation that we filmed was, it seemed at the time, and perhaps still, the most likely place that they could find. That plantation had some access to the sea, but it wasn't like really close, and a lot of it would have been feeling like living far more inland than, you know, the islanders have ever lived. I think the government is aware that they really want to try and find a place that has access to the sea, but the reality is living on Bougainville is a completely different type of life than living on the island. I mean, Bougainville is an island, but it's much larger, and the main way that people earn money there is working as farmers on plantations, and that would be what the islanders would also have to do. So for, you know, part of the story really, and one of the interests I have in this is that, you know, how do a seafaring community that have lived together all their lives, you know, how do they change and adjust to something like that? I mean, it's quite dramatic for them. I mean, there's malaria there. It's a completely different culture, Melanesian, not Polynesian. And I think one of the other things that's really quite problematic about it is that Bougainville has had a 10-year civil war. So people are very sensitive about land, and part of the reason why the government are finding it so hard to find a place is that no one wants to sell their land, and, you know, there's a lot of hostility to new people.
One of the aspects that, just in terms of making the film, and you talked about it afterwards when people asked you questions in the theater there, was this whole aspect of, you mentioned the island is very difficult to get to. Boats do not come on a consistent basis. You know, you're not exactly sure when the next boat is coming. And you mentioned the costs for changing plane tickets, I think, at one point. Which kind of, I said to myself, I think a lot of people did too, could never do such a film because the costs would just be insane. How did you manage in the end? Because you did have to pay a lot of penalties.
I really don't know how we managed to make this film. it was an insane film to make. And I have to say a lot of credit is due to Lynn Colley, who the other producer on the film, who really managed all of those logistical nightmares. And there were many of them because the visas to get into Papua New Guinea were also very difficult. And I mean, there's a lot of things you can't anticipate and a lot of things you don't know where you're going to spend your money on. So in terms of how we managed to pay, I mean, this film really was done as a project of love. You know, not really many people in the entire production were paid for their time and their work. So, I mean, that was really the one way that we got around it, is not paying ourselves and just doing a lot of things in a very guerrilla filmmaking style, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think I do, because I incorporate some of those tactics in my work. But that actually goes back to something real basic that I don't remember asking or hearing about. Where did the funding come from for the project?
So we got some of the funding came from New Zealand. We had money from the Screen Innovation Production Fund, which is like an arts grant, and then the New Zealand Film Commission. But the majority of our funding came from Pacific Islanders in Communication, which is a US minority consortia for PBS. So it's a group of a funding organization that funds projects for US public television that are to do with Pacific Island stories.
Yeah.
And that was a really great thing that they came on board, and really thanks to them we could actually make the film, because we were having a lot of trouble finding money, and it was really at a point where I thought, oh, I don't know if we can keep going like this, keeping on getting declines. And then PIC, Pacific Islanders, came on board, and that was when we could really finish the film.
Hmm. Yeah, because that was one of my questions. I mean, I think that's a question for any documentary maker these days, independent journalists. You know, where does the money come from? How do you get it? And will it be enough for your project? I mean, in this case, it worked out, and that's excellent.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a real challenge, but it's you know, there is money out there, and I think filmmakers are learning to be more creative in the way that they get money. In New Zealand, it's pretty limited where you can get funding, and I know a lot of New Zealand filmmakers tend to make films about New Zealand because that's really the only way they can get money, for stories that have local content in them. And because our film wasn't that, we really had to follow a American funding model, which I'd seen other filmmakers do, and that is, you know, maybe go out and shoot some footage first with your own money and then use that as a sort of trailer or promotion to show other people and then get them inspired and get lots of little bits of money from a whole lot of different places, like, you know, some individuals, funding parties, organizations, foundations, and then that's the way you raise your funds. And it's a slower process, but sometimes you can get more traction from the film by doing it that way as well.
Yeah. And so the film now, I mean, there have been a few screenings in Europe. I've read about a screening in New Zealand. Oh, it's passed already. I think I was reading past entries. Where does it go from here in terms of the big, what do you call them, the big moments? Like the IDFA was definitely, I think, one.
Yeah, the IDFA was an amazing moment for us. I mean, it's the biggest documentary film festival in the world, and it's got a really great reputation and screens really good films. So that was a special moment for us. And same with the New Zealand International Film Festival, because we managed to show the film to sort of a huge community of people who had been supporting us for many years. The film has screened like in many parts of the world now, and next it will go to hopefully a PBS broadcast on American television, one in Europe on German and French television, and a few other places that we are selling it to different broadcasters. And if we get some time, we'd really like to try and even do a little theatrical release in the States, and then continue to do community screenings, because we've had a lot of requests for people who want to, you know, show the film to their different organizations. I mean, this film seems to relate to people who are talking about the issue of democracy or the issue of climate change and, you know, adaptation and different kinds of themes like that. So, yeah, it's seeming to be a sort of a film that can create a lot of discussion around these issues, and people like to screen it.
I wanted to ask you, you've laid out everything when it comes to the film screenings and the film being completed and what to do next. But I do wonder, because I have that after a big project, what do you feel like doing as a follow-up? I mean, what are you thinking to do? I mean, I can only imagine you want to return to the island, because I think I would.
Yeah, so it's very important to me to get back to the island at some point. I think, just from an ethical point of view, you know, when you go in and you make this film and then you leave, and it's quite strange how you go all around the world with the story and people are seeing the story, and yet I don't have regular contact with people on the island.
Yeah.
So it's very important that I go back, but it's all about how to get back and organizing the right time to get back, because it's so hard to get on a boat and get there. You have to kind of arrange your life around it and allow yourself maybe even 3 months to sort of sort out how, when and how you're going to get there. So it's definitely on the cards for maybe next year. But in the meantime, I've sent a copy of the film with the ethnomusicologist who I mentioned earlier, Richard Moyle, who took it to the island so that the community could watch the film and, you know, at least have seen it while everyone else is seeing it.
Yeah.
And then to answer your question about what I would want to do when I get back, I think the one thing that I'd really like to do is, if in the film the scientists who visit the island say they will make a report about maybe things that the islanders could do to adapt to this issue of climate change so that not all of these people have to actually relocate. And I think that's something that I learned through the process of making the film, that there are other options for the islanders and that relocation isn't the most obvious and straightforward option. And so I would really like to be able to work with the community more on that and maybe share this information the scientists are going to be providing for the community. And I mean, we've even been talking, some of myself and some of the scientists, about even trying to set up a project that could maybe help the community stay on the island for a longer period of time. Maybe that would involve building a different kind of seawall or something like that. I mean, we're not sure if this will happen, but we are actually setting up a fund for the community, and this, if there is money that can go towards that, maybe that could go towards this idea that we have.
Yeah, yeah. Because I mean, you already essentially have in this film, I think, a big collection of different people speaking not only about the issue but about what they do and their traditions. And I'm already obsessed with that kind of thing in my own family, and as well as what I do with my podcast. Like, I don't know where it comes from, but my obsession is with preserving and recording, and so that no matter what happens, we can still go back. And even on the island, whether they leave or not, I think what's really great about doing what you've been doing is you have that archive, that living archive that they can enjoy, that others can learn from, regardless of, you know, if you have to leave the island or not in the future. So in that sense, I also really I really dig what you've done. I want to make sure, there goes an ambulance outside my house.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make sure that people get the essential information for finding, I mean, they could definitely watch the trailer online. The site is thereoncewasanisland.com, and that's not only good for the trailer, but that's good for lots of information about the film, the background of the film, and the taking action section, which is I think also a great aspect of the website. Is there other essential details I should pass out to people?
Well, there's also a blog, which is really, really fascinating. And when you go to the website, you can see you can click on the blog. And this blog we actually wrote while we were filming. And we would upload information on a satellite phone every 2 days. And it's really fascinating reading about how we made the film. You know, you mentioned about how difficult it was to get there and the plane tickets and all this stuff. So you can find out some really interesting stories. And as well as that, we're now developing an interactive aspect to the website. It hasn't been launched yet, but it's going to have additional information about the film, about the issues of adaptation, relocation, and interviews with us, and also extra footage that we never put in the film. So this will be a really interesting experience once we have it up for people to actually engage with the film on another level, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Cool. Okay, well, Briar March, thank you so much. I really enjoyed seeing the film. I'm sorry that I didn't go, I'm sorry to myself for not coming up to you in person, but I was sick at the time and I thought, I'll just sneeze on her. It'll be terrible.
So. I'm sick as well.
Okay.
See, yeah, no, that's fine. And thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, yeah, no, it was a pleasure. And well, we'll definitely speak in the future. I'd love to have you back on the podcast. We can do an update and all that kind of good stuff. So, so thanks a lot. And we'll make sure that we end it there in case the internet leaves us.
Okay. Okay. Cool. See you later.
WikiLeaks, what's next? WikiLeaks, what's next? Don't stop now, we're on the edge of our seats. What's next? WikiLeaks, what's next? WikiLeaks, what's next? Well, don't stop now, we're on the edge of our seats. You have to watch what you say or your words will haunt you. Take extra care when you speak. One of these days you just might find your foot stuck in your cheek. With a flabby old chap and Hitler hobnobbing and the head of a snake. And Batman and Robin, there's just no place to hide your disgrace. You got egg all over your face. Have ears, is your conscience clear? If you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear. The walls have ears and the coast isn't clear. If you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear. Our friends are thin-skinned, feckless and vain, with a crazy old man and another just strange. Don't corner Merkel, she'll become tenacious. She's risk-averse and rarely creative. Some are abysmal or taking their meds, while others won't keep their promises. Get freaking flyer miles of Bonky Moon. His biometric data will need it soon. WikiLeaks, what's next? WikiLeaks, what's next? Our freedom of press, our freedom of speech. What's next? WikiLeaks, what's next? WikiLeaks, what's next? Our freedom of press, our freedom of speech. Don't stress, free the press, don't stress, free the press. Let the chips fall where they may. The truth will come out, ready or not, fess up to what you say. Blaming the mirror for what you see diverts the responsibility. To stifle the leak is just doublespeak if you claim the press is free. WikiLeaks, what's next? WikiLeaks, what's next? Well, don't stop now, we're on the edge of our seats. What's next, WikiLeaks? We cannot wait to know. The cat is out of the bag, so on with the show. The world's outraged and it's no surprise. You've been accused of telling no lies. Protecting secrets is the job of the state. They failed their job, yet they're irate. And now there's a witch hunt, we've seen this before. They need someone to blame to even the score. Blaming the postman for the letter he brings is like blaming the weatherman for the wind when it stings.